Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's January 18, 2015, and welcome to episode 92 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting, and collecting, and collecting, and books. Good morning, hosties. How are you? Up in the north, in the cold, cold lands, we have Carrington. How are you, Carrington?
I'm wonderful. Spread the word. Spread the word of Carrington.
And nearby in sunny Montreal, how are you, Paul?
Oh, I'm doing great. It is actually, above zero today.
Oh, I wish I could say it was just above zero here.
But that's French zero, so
it is.
And in still in our northerly climes, hi Jack, how are you?
I'm pretty good. It's equally cold here in Sweden, I will say. Also just above French zero, or Swedish zero.
Zero.
And down here in sunny, humid, stinking hot Sydney, it's myself. So, hi everybody. We need a host topic. And I checked my books and I thought, well, books, there's a good topic. Do we still need them for our retro addiction? Or hobby, as some would call it? Are PDFs better? Or do you prefer dead tree flesh? How do you store and use them? Can you have too many? Of course you can't have too many. Reprints, new editions, or are you after the 30-plus-year-old originals? So, guys, how do you stand on books for your retro computers? Carrington, the man who collects everything but keeps nothing.
Yes, a long time ago, I decided that for reference materials, I would prefer them digitally because I want to dip in and out of them. I want to find things. I want to be able to just, I want to search. That's the most important thing. So I switched over as much as I could to having all reference materials, including, say, programming guides, in some sort of digital format. I have subsequently also switched over to pretty much everything else digitally. I prefer to read on my Kindle or iPad. I just, in general, prefer books digitally. That said, I also lately, for some reason, have been picking up and reading Apple II programming books on, you know, dead tree. I've been lately reading the Apple Graphics and Arcade Game Design book, I think it is called, by Jeffrey Stanton, because I've got a game idea I want to knock out for Kansas Fest, so I'm sort of teaching myself that, and I've actually been really enjoying reading it in book format. But for the most part, I prefer digital stuff, although I don't like things in PDF format. The problem I have with PDF is it is a skeuomorphic thing. Like, it locks down pages to be the equivalent of a printed page that I don't have. It doesn't let me expand things. It doesn't let me... I really just want plain text that can be poured into whatever format I'm viewing it on. And that is, alas, rarely available. So that's what I prefer, but I don't really get it much.
Yeah, I'm with you on those PDFs, especially when they still end up hyperlinking to the chapters or the elements in there. And you go, well, I'm hyperlinking into this section that I want to read. Why do I have to flip between page 27 and 28 to actually read it all?
Or it might be reading on a device that has a different aspect ratio than the published paper. It's something from the UK. It's on A4 paper, and I've got it on, say, an iPad or an iPhone or my Kindle, and it just end up with a huge margin in two of the four spaces, and just that kind of stuff is a pain.
No, I definitely like my EPUB formats along that way. But yes, unfortunately, a lot of the books do get archived into a PDF format, more for its universal or perceived universal access. But yeah, so Paul, being a man of books, where do you stand on them?
Yeah, so, well, usually in the corner. It's funny, I was sort of expecting that we would all just agree, but in fact, you know, for space reasons and so forth, I can't collect actual physical books, and I, you know, I've sort of become I've been all along kind of a electronics person, so I'm fine reading the things on screens and so forth, but I definitely actually like, you know, particularly for magazines and things like this, I like the ability to see the page as it was, you know, particularly if I'm not going to have the magazine anymore, but just the scan of it, or if I never had it and got it from someone else who scanned it. Although I like the idea of being able to search and find and quickly, you know, get to what you're looking for, I do not want to lose the actual image of the page. When it's something like, you know, the Stanton book or something, it maybe isn't as important to have all the lines, you know, end in the same places that they did. But yeah, I think that it would be definitely better to just sort of make these things available in some form, just because there aren't actually that many copies left or out there. So, you know, and there are a lot of interesting programming books. There are an unbelievable number of, like, 6502 programming books that have been written. I had no idea in the day. But,
yeah, I think I've got a large number of them, and I still have never been a successful 6502 programmer. I can fiddle, I can hack, but I've never actually written my own program from scratch. Okay, so, Jack, I'm sure you've got bookcases and bookcases just filled with retro computing books and magazines and other ephemera. So, would that be true?
You might think so. And I do definitely have bookcases full of all sorts of books, but I think I reached kind of a period at some point in my life where I just realized I just got too many books in general of any kind. And so since I started delving into the retro computing realm in the past couple of years, really, the only books that I've collected are entirely just digital. And I agree with what you're saying about the issue with PDFs. It's kind of, it's a mixed blessing, right? It's a thing where you have the, it can be good to have the page layout as it was, and at the same time, if you're viewing it on an iPad, it can be just sort of a pain in the neck to have all the fonts in the wrong sizes and text blocks shifted in the wrong places and, you know, trying to wrap the page to a width that doesn't make sense. So I don't know, it's kind of a pain. I think there's not really a good solution for digital books in general. And this is the thing where some of them you want to have, you know, they might have some graphics or graphs in the book that are interesting. Many of them you'd rather just have text. I think the worst thing is that when you see a book that was clearly printed on paper on courier in courier font and then scanned in and turned into a digital PDF without having the font converted back into a font, and you just, I've seen a couple of those and it just drives me nuts. It's like, okay, this is just a text file and it's become a PDF instead. It's just, I don't know, pet peeve of mine. But anyway, my collection is entirely digital when it comes to retro computing stuff.
I do agree with what Paul said, though, that there's a real advantage when it comes to something like a magazine. I prefer that as a in-my-hands printed original magazine. That those are fun, but I'm not using that as a reference thing. I'm now just reading it for pleasure. And I want to see the ads, and I want to, you know, feel it, and it's sort of like having original old hardware. There's something special about like an old copy of Insider or something. So I actually prefer those, and if it's going to be a digital copy, I would want it to be basically just a high quality scan and in PDF format. That's totally fine when it comes to something like a magazine. It's nice if it's still searchable, but I wouldn't want the format changed, whereas when it's like a technical reference, I really just want the raw text that I can pour into something else.
Yeah, so basically that's where I am. I like my magazines. I like sort of like sitting down and just flipping through the old magazines. But when it comes to programming reference material, then I do like the full flow aspect, I suppose, of an EPUB over a PDF. So no prizes for guessing that I'm old school when it comes to books. I can't seem to get enough and I can't let go of them, hence the large number of bookcases down in the 8-bit bunker. But and funny we should be talking about books, because I just found another box of books spent a little bit of Saturday getting them up onto the shelf and rearranging some shelves so that I could fit them in. So so much for my New Year resolution of cutting back on books.
That didn't last long.
No. That resolution sort of, it died. But so.
I might add, so there are certain specific things like old Apple manuals and things like the little spiral bound, original manual that I used when I was learning AppleSoft and that kind of thing. These I like. And I do kind of collect the physical copies of, sort of important or, sort of related to obsession books. So, yeah, I think that is sort of a different category. And I definitely, Apple is the thing that I tend to collect a lot of. And if I see one of those old little spiral manuals that, I know I've never seen before, I will try to get it.
Yeah. So on to, say, scans of books and magazines. The thing I've been noticing lately is, although that there are PDF copies of these books and magazines floating around, the quality of the scanning is not that great. I suppose when they were originally digitized, that was pretty much the standard of the day. But some of those diagrams and pictures and things are sort of really crying out for the originals to be rescanned at a much higher resolution. And just a book that I've purchased recently on building cards for computers, and I had a look at the shots of the book on eBay, and I thought, oh, yeah, that's exactly what I've been looking for. I'll get that book, and then went and found the PDF and had a look at the PDF, and some of the board diagrams and schematics were less than useful. And I was thinking, oh, well, I'll just scan this, because, again, it's a spiral-bound book, so I could just easily ease out the spiral and just drop the book onto a flatbed scanner with a document feeder, and was just talking about it on Facebook, and then someone said, eh, I've got that book. It's not much better quality than the PDFs that you're looking at. And I went, oh, facepalm. So unfortunately, that's the other thing. So we're talking about books 30, 40 years old, even then the techniques used for small publishing runs weren't that great, and they really weren't that much better than a third-generation photocopy in some cases. So are there any books that you've got that you suffer from that you can't sort of read the diagrams in your digital version, and it's not that much easier on hard copy?
I haven't run into that so much, but I've spent so much time, collecting and putting books on shelves that I haven't had much time to open them.
Oh.
So you don't know.
It's always sort of a debate whenever I'm scanning something, just because, these files are huge when, we're talking about like a 200-page book or something, or 200-page magazine. Do you really want like a 580-megabyte, file for each issue?
And that's the compressed version.
Yeah, I definitely try, when I'm doing scanning of my own, I try to sort of optimize it in some way, and usually keep two copies and spend a lot of money on hard drives.
Yeah.
But
I've gone the other way lately. Oh, not even just lately, for a few years now, I have decided that I have infinite storage, and I treat everything I do accordingly. I've stopped deleting anything. Everything I scan at the highest quality possible. I just keep and create the biggest, highest version of everything. Every podcast I do, if I produce it, I make a full 256 megabit, stereo complete. Now it's a different version that I'll throw out on the net right now, because it's a pain for people to have, multiple hundreds of megabyte files to download for their podcasts. But the only copy I keep is the super huge one, because I can always make a crappier version later. Same thing with scans. Same thing with all the documents I create. Because I have found, I've sort of hit a tipping point now where data storage is so crazy cheap that I'm buying like each drive in the multiple terabytes that a couple hundred extra megabytes here and there, it's like a rounding error now. And anything I think is a big deal size-wise won't be a big deal 3 years from now, 5 years from now. In a relatively short time frame, there's no document I can make that will be anything other than a small hiccup in data, no big deal. So I've sort of changed my mindset completely and just think everything should be as big as possible and as good as possible, given whatever tech I have at hand.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'm starting to get hard drives all over the place with the video and digital photography that my wife and I do, as well as scans and whatnot. But when I was doing a lot of video editing back in the early 2000s, people were impressed when they would come over and see, that I'd have terabytes of storage hooked up to my network of computers. You know, it's all made up of multi-hundred gigabyte drives. But at one stage, I think in 2005, I had like 4.5 terabytes of storage, most of it for video. And now you just pop out and you can buy a 5 terabyte, 3.5 inch drive, slap it into your machine, and there's your storage woes solved for another week.
Yeah, it's really more bandwidth still lags behind on that, so that's the bummer. But also because, I guess, like you, because I do video editing, since I have so many terabytes of storage for that, everything else is so tiny. Like, any scan is so tiny compared to any, like, if you have an hour and a half long film and all the footage that goes into that, it's all so much larger than anything else I have that everything else kind of doesn't matter.
Now, I was doing a lot of family video, so things coming in from Video 8 format, digitizing that into whatever I needed to use at the time. I agree with you. You bring it in at the highest quality that you possibly can, and then you just worry about storage.
Yeah, and the more I've lived with data, I've sort of come to realize that in the many, many years, now decades, I have been dealing with computerized data, there has never been an instance that I wished I had a worse version of something. Like, I've never gone back, gosh, I wish I had scanned that at a lower quality. I wish I had, never. But many times I've looked at an old photo and gone, oh, darn, I wish I hadn't cropped that. Or I wish I had the full color gamut still in it. I wish I had the version before I did that crappy filter. Or I wish I had the original. Like, often I wish I had a better quality version of something, but never do I want a smaller file or a worse quality. And so I finally have learned that lesson.
Okay, so basically when these books of mine come in, I should really just scan them at a higher resolution, touch them up where I can, and then basically just re-push out that higher quality scan, and that will sort of help out other people as well. So
on your shoulders be it.
Oh yes. Yes, on the shoulders of giants before us. Okay, so let's just wrap up our books. So where are you those of us who are still interested in books, where are you finding them these days? I've noticed that book sales and library remainders and things like that are sort of starting to dry up as far as books and garage sales. You're not finding 30-year-old computer texts and magazines anymore. So, I've really dropped off from doing going to garage sales or boot sales or whatever you want to call them, because the old stuff that is in there, for me, is not old enough these days. It's just new junk. So is anyone still managing to find books, rummage sales, and other similar events, or are you now sort of just buying them online, eBay, or from Abbey Books, or Amazon for old editions?
Well, I rarely leave the house, so I think a lot of the books that I have wound up with, I've gotten through eBay, but you often want to, if you see something on eBay, that will give you an idea, but then you might want to look around.
Oh, because, yes.
It's quite possible that Amazon will have it for, 75 cents when the eBay thing you saw is, $25. So, and sometimes it goes the other way too. Sometimes Amazon can list some pretty crazy prices.
Yeah, I agree on that one there. You find them sometimes on eBay and at eBay prices, and then you just go looking. So actually just looking at my bookshelf here, and there's an example of one that I did sort of, I don't know why I found it on eBay, but It's a text on ADA, Advanced Introduction, including reference manual for ADA programming language. And that was, I think, it's one of these lovely big hardcover Prentice Hall books. And so I didn't quite like the price of that one there, and I actually just found it on Abbey Books. They consolidate lots of booksellers. I think this one actually came from a Canadian seller from memory, and then, yeah. And it's an ex-library book and in good condition, unfortunately minus the dust cover, as back in those days a lot of dust covers went by the way when books went into the library. But
is that how it's pronounced? Abbey Books? We're talking about ABEBOOKS.com, right?
Well, the webpage isn't telling me to pronounce it any other way.
I've always said Abe Books or ABE Books, but I think they just capitalized the A. So I've always said Abe Books, even though it's very hard to say that. It doesn't roll off the tongue.
I know, I've heard.
And I was never really sure how it was supposed to be pronounced.
You're probably right, but I agree with you. It's not something that rolls off the tongue. So as far as I'm concerned, it's Abbey Books.
I like that site a lot. I've used it for, oh my gosh, now, I guess, I don't know, since mid-90s, was it, or late-90s when it started? Like, forever. Mm. You won't necessarily find bargains there, but at least you can very quickly search the shelves of bookshops around the world. It's a great alternative to eBay when you're dealing with books and magazines.
It's a superb aggregator, and they just basically take care of the transaction and everything for you, and you then get an email from a small bookseller somewhere on planet Earth, and then it arrives. It's excellent. I love it. But unfortunately, sometimes you just don't find it in aggregators like that, and you have to, well, you don't have to pay eBay prices, but if I see a book that I like, I get it. Okay, well, I think that's fairly much covered books for now. So, dear listener, if you have a view on books or PDFs or scans or digital editions or anything like that, drop us a line. Okay, so we have some listener feedback.
Yep. So relating to episode 91, Sebastian wrote to alert us to the fact that the Amiga is still alive. So he pointed us to a website called AmigaOS.net, where there's fair amount of current activity still going on with hardware and software and OS development. I haven't dug too deep into it, but just so that everybody knows, to the extent that we said the Amiga didn't have a continuing life, there is apparently still quite some activity there.
And especially if there's still OS development, then that's more alive than a lot of the computers we talk about. You can't say that the Apple II still is alive in that sense, or the OS is being developed or changed at all.
No, I meant to say on the last show that at the OzKay Fest, the previous one up in Brisbane, that someone did actually bring along a more recent machine, and they were running Amiga OS on it. They just sort of brought along, as they were Apple and Amiga fan, and they thought they'd just bring along a more modern machine running the Amiga OS, and they had all the sides stripped off it and showing all the hardware and all the extra bits and pieces that they were running on there. And I was quite impressed that there was modern developments in a let's say at a classic operating system. So I was impressed. I should have brought that up, and Sebastian, I hang my head in shame, and thank you for reminding us.
Well, I think that the modern Amiga OS only runs on machines that have been upgraded to a PowerPC. So Commodore never sold Amigas with a built-in PowerPC, but third parties started going that route as like a way to sort of boost your Amiga at some point. And I think that the Amiga OS now runs only on those upgraded machines. Interesting, does not seem to have been ported to like PowerPC Macs, of which there are many more. So like if you want to run this, you have to get an appropriate old Amiga of some kind and buy the appropriate PowerPC booster card of some kind. Doable, but a little bit off the wall.
But still quite cool.
Yeah, off the wall. I think off the wall describes a lot of us retro computer enthusiasts.
That's true.
Okay, well, on to items of interest, or at least we think they are interesting. Carrington, you've got that strange word against your name.
Commodore, yes, bucking tradition. Since Earl's not here, I will open us with a bit of Commodore news. Well, not really news, but an interesting thing that appeared on Hackaday recently. It's entitled Making the CES Show 30 Years Ago. Of course, CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, recently took place. But this article is about the 1985 CES, and it's written from a fellow named Bill Hurd, who attended as one of the people in the Commodore booth. He was a Commodore employee at the time, a tech fellow, I think. And it's got some great vintage photos, just a couple of them, but it's neat to see. Like, here is the Commodore booth from 1985 CES show, and here's the room that they were, you know, frantically scrabbling to get all the computers that would be displayed, put them together and get them functioning. And so he talks about that, and you get a sense of not really a lot of details, unfortunately, but you get a good sense of what it felt like and kind of the frantic nature and then the come down at the end when suddenly, oh, I'm finished. And so what it was like for a relatively young fellow, I think he's mid-20s at the time, to attend as an exhibitor in CES, but in the 1980s. Now, I do take... I wouldn't say necessarily umbrage, but there's a sentence in here where you sort of... describes what went on, and he says he had just delivered. We're talking about the Commodore 128. Had just delivered one of the major products for the best computer company in the world. I might take exception to both the first and second part of that sentence, but that said, it's a really interesting article. So if you're a fan of Commodore, I think it's a must read. But even if you're just a fan of like 1980s computer shows, here's some photos I'd never seen before, some information I'd never seen before. It's a fast but really interesting read, and we'll have a link in the show notes over to Hackaday.com. Definitely worth checking out.
Well, what I found very interesting about the photos is that apart from the large chicken head Commodore banner across there, it looks just like a computer exposition that I would have gone to but months ago. Apart from the style of dress of everyone there, quite a few sports jackets, but it just looks like another computer show. They don't seem to have sort of changed the layout that much over the years.
In my business, I attend a lot of trade shows and franchising shows and home shows and this sort of thing. I go to and either attend or exhibit multiple times a month, every month throughout the entire year. And I agree.
It's deja vu.
The technology and the nature of exhibiting, either technology or otherwise, has not seemed to have changed in 30 years. It's the same stuff over and over. Oh my gosh, kill me now. But
I should just to mention, Bill Hurd actually is a pretty big name in the Commodore world. He designed the C128 actually.
Oh, so. Sorry, Bill. Well, there you go.
No, I just love the way that Carrington was understating his importance. So, like,
we don't
want him to sort of get tickets on himself, but. Yes, I've been to many trade shows, and you walk in, and then you just suddenly literally have that deja vu moment, and sort of like, why am I here? It just looks exactly the same as last year and the year before.
And that said, though, well, going to CES would bore me to tears now. Having a time machine and going to CES 1985 or 1982 or something like that would be a thrill.
I would
give anything to attend 1985 CES. I just don't want to attend 2015 CES.
Everyone picks up on the same theme and just keep walking past booth after booth, and it's not even a variation on a theme. They're just trying to promote the almost the same thing. It's just, yeah, same old these days. Okay, so we have a little bit of a birthday call here. The 8080 chip is 40 this year, so this is one that we missed in our 80s series of podcasts. So in 1974, it was the basis of the MITS Altair 8800. All our favorite hardware is getting older. So anyone here ever used a machine with a 8080 in it?
Well, I had the Altair.
Oh, that's right, you did. You were a little switch flipper, yeah.
Yes, young Carrington was indeed a switch flipper. They called me that in high school. You switch flipper. I did. So I had it. I completed a kit that's like I got it basically kind of through a garage sale of somebody else's incomplete system that I then finished and then owned. And I dug it, but I didn't love it the way I later loved subsequent computers that came out not too long after that were more a modern computer, you know, keyboard and like the Apple II and stuff. So I dug it, but I didn't get super crazy into it. I just, you know, was loving it because that's what was available.
Mm. Yeah, I accept the machine for its importance in the timeline of computing, but again, it's something which I just haven't really clicked on. If I came across one, yes, I would love to have it in my collection, but it's not something that I would want to get hold of. It's, as you said, it's not something which is eminently usable. I think the thrill would have been more in the assembly of it and getting it going, and then I would have been soldering iron away and pretty soon moving on to my next task.
What I found most interesting from the article was that everybody interviewed in it, though, mostly what they say is, yeah, we're still doing the same things. It's too limited. We got to do things based on biological systems, you know, the universal Turing machines, like the whole von Neumann architecture, way too limiting. There's a major bottleneck. We got to switch to biological-based systems. I found that very interesting because here are people that were at the forefront of this and basically invented the chip architecture that we're still essentially using now, and they're saying, okay, it's been too long. Let's have a major change. So that was the most interesting part of this article. Mm,
most definitely. So yes, reaching that point where there's effectively limits to what you can cram in onto that silicon wafer.
Yeah, and then the whole bottleneck, the idea that your computational elements and the data fetching elements are sharing a bus is just too essential a bottleneck, and we've got to jump to a completely different sort of architecture if we want to take things to the next level. And it's just interesting that these are the people that are saying that, you know, given their history with the chips.
So. Okay, Paul, this is an interesting one. Tell me more.
Yeah. Yes, okay. So, since our last show, there has, on archiveart.org, there's been a big collection of MS-DOS games posted. So, this is sort of part of the same basic project that the Internet Archive and, you know, most loudly Jason Scott has been working on, trying to make old computers and software run in web browsers. What has happened here is, this one isn't using MS, it's using a port of DOSBox. But there was difficulty up until recently, basically just being able to get the PC emulated properly in a browser. And so they turned to port DOSBox instead. So now there's, you know, like 2,500, you know, individual games up there that you can launch and run. It's neat. I was looking through the list myself and realizing, you know, I never really played many MS-DOS games. So I was looking for something that I would remember. And, what I mainly saw was that, there are a lot of games that I knew from other platforms that I didn't know were ported. But, so I played Karateka a little bit and, So, Wolfenstein 3D, but yeah, so it's a major undertaking, and again, I'm not exactly sure who the army is that worked on this. You know, Jason is the one who is the mouthpiece for it.
Holds the banner high and gets everyone's attention on. Yeah, he's definitely quite loud on Twitter. But I believe one of the interesting things with this is that they're actually playing the DOS games out of the ZIP archive. So rather than having all the files all there, it's basically you are selecting the ZIP archive and then you'll start playing the game out of it. So and sound was definitely the difficult part, getting it synchronized with what you're actually playing at the time. So great work, guys, at the Internet Archive. And if there's a favorite MS-DOS game, pop over to the archive, link included, and see if your game's there. And, we'll have to now sort of see what they can do for the other platforms. Now, the disk images and everything are available for a lot of the games for our platforms, but I think it's just getting that web browser interface going to it that's just making it the experience just so much better, being able to just from anywhere on any internet-connected device get in and play a game or look at some other old software. I think it's great.
Yeah, and it's not just games too. I mean, like the games list that we link to is just games, but other things work. And one of the things that Jason tweeted about was getting an old tracker, you know, like a what were those called? Mod files, you know, running that he remembered.
Fast tracker, scream tracker, one of these things for making music.
Right.
Right.
So and the other thing too is that it's quick. I mean, you know, like Wolfenstein 3D looked like Wolfenstein 3D. I mean, and that's like 3D animation. Karateka actually ran too fast. So it's pretty impressive.
Oh, well, it's good that we got big fat pipes on the internet and fast but bottlenecked processors on our computers. And we're happily running our old software, you know, in a web browser. So, Jack, looks like we've got another happy birthday call out here.
Yep, yet another one. So this month, 30 years ago, the Atari ST line of computers was announced, also at the CES, the winter CES that we mentioned a few minutes ago. They didn't actually have the product then. The product didn't ship until June, I think. But it's a pretty interesting story behind the whole thing, because just a year before that, but at this time, 30 years ago, in 1985, Jack Tramiel was the head of Atari. The year before that, he was still the head of Commodore, and had just announced on stage at Winter CES that Commodore had made, I don't know, some ungodly amount of money on selling computers, mostly the Commodore 64, I guess. Like, they made like $3 billion or something. It was just outrageous. And like 2 days later, he quit. He was gone from Commodore. So within a very short space of time, he left Commodore, started a new company, took people with him to start creating a new 16/32-bit computer based on 68000. And around the middle of the year, he realized that Atari was up for sale from Warner, who owned it at that time. He went and bought Atari, sort of reshaped everything. Basically, he kind of created a new company. He took in some of the old people from Atari and some of his old people from Commodore. And within a 12-month period of time, he went to saying, here, I have a new computer that we're making. 6 months later, it was out. It's a pretty fast turnaround, actually. And I think the other interesting thing is that going on at the same time, in the background of this, was that Atari had initially, some guys from there, Jay Miner and some others, had left because they wanted to make a new computer architecture. They started making the Amiga, and I think it was around this time, I think maybe back in like 83, Atari lent them a bunch of money and said, okay, if you don't pay the money back within a year, then we own the rights to what you're doing for a while for something. And what happened instead was that after Jack Tramiel had sold or had left Commodore, Commodore gave Amiga the money to pay Atari back, and Commodore bought Amiga. So there was this weird sort of swap of kind of teams and development technologies. So that's the reason why the Amiga is in some ways kind of the technical successor to the Atari 8-bits, much more than the Atari ST is. So anyway, weird little bit of old trivia there. I had an Atari ST for a few years in the late 80s, and it did some things okay. I overall, by the end of the time I had it, wished I would have just gone straight into buying an Amiga instead. I would have had more fun with that during those couple years, I think, but it was what it was. Anyway, happy 30th birthday, Atari ST.
Nicely timed, because the 8080 was 10.
Yes. So, Carrington, ein Facelift für den Macintosh?
Yes, I will give this whole section in German. So this bit of news is something that just makes my heart ache with desire. Every once in a while, there'll be a product that I just, like, deep inside me, I just think that is just so beautiful and so right. And I felt that way about a few real-world computer products. The first time I saw a Macintosh, I was just blown away by that. I had never personally encountered or used a computer with a GUI, and it was immediately the future. I felt like that with the iPhone as well. I felt like that the first time I used an Apple II, because it had the slots and stuff, and it had a built-in keyboard. It was just stunning. And there's been a number of products, non-Apple ones included, that have just, you know, blown me away. And then every once in a while, somebody will design something and say, well, here's an idea for a product, and it'll be interesting. And usually you look at it and think, oh, that's wonderful, but that couldn't exist in the real world. And that's what I thought when I first saw this. So Curved Labs, which is a German company, a design company, it seems, has come up with, and somehow through magic, I suppose, actually produced a computer that harkens back to the original Toaster Mac shape. But imagine if you took one of those and you just sliced off like a 1 centimeter thick bit of the front of it and just said, let's just take that. So the computer has the same front size, although a little larger, of as if you were staring face on to, say, a Mac Plus. But if you look from the side, all the computer is gone except for 1 little centimeter. You think, well, how is this possible? But it's actually a product, not for sale, alas, but is functional, has a battery built in, so it even can, you know, just be plopped down and it's working. It uses the guts ripped out of a MacBook Air, the 11-inch, and a small, more 4x3 ratio touchscreen. And it's stunning. It's something where it was making the rounds on the internet, and I'd see the pictures and immediately figured, well, that's a wonderful Photoshop mock-up. That can't be a thing. But it's a thing, and I want it so badly, and I think it's lovely, and I suspect that it's going to actually have influence on things, because I can imagine like a mini iMac or something. I suspect the designers at Apple will have the same little heart butterflies that I had when you see this, something that is just this beautiful. So we'll have a link in the show notes, and I want it with such a deep want.
Yeah, it is really something.
When I saw it the first time, it was a case definitely sort of, you know, shut up, take my money, give me one now.
Well, I didn't think it was a thing.
No.
I thought, well, this Photoshop, this can't—you can't really make a computer. And the first time I saw a MacBook Air, you know, when the original one, the uselessly underpowered, you know, almost couldn't use it, bad MacBook Air, but it was so crazy thin and it slid out of that envelope, and that was impressive. This is far more than that. Like, this doesn't look like a product that can exist. When you see it, you think, well, there cannot be a monitor in that space. But of course, in the lid of a modern laptop, they are as thin as this model. So yes, you can have a display that thin, but just the whole body is so thin. You think, well, where is the rest of it? Like, where is the computer? This cannot be a product. And it's so achingly beautiful. I just absolutely love it.
This detail of having the little SD card where the floppy goes is also brilliant.
Yeah. It's gorgeous. I totally adore it. Like, I just, it's small. I don't think I could actually full-time use a computer with such a small monitor nowadays. Like, I've got my SE30 and I adore it, but and at one point in my life, that was totally fine. In the same way that for a long time, a 640 by 480 13-inch color screen was more than enough for me to do desktop publishing on. But nowadays, I look at the screen that's in front of me right now with all the various windows that I have open just for podcasting. I can't imagine working on this tiny little screen. But that doesn't matter. I want it. I want it so bad. It's just the most beautiful thing I've seen technology-wise in many years.
I think it would have made a perfect anniversary Mac of some variety. Like the 20th anniversary Mac was basically just a rehash of parts that were available. But,
But this as a 30th anniversary Mac, which is sort of the idea behind it. Absolutely. And I can imagine that you'd say we're making a few of them and they're selling for, you know, $15,000. It would be some outrageous fee, in which case, you know, I wouldn't be buying one, but I would want it. I want it to exist as a product. Mm.
No, it just cries out, make me.
Yeah, I bet if the designers did a Kickstarter, they would have no trouble raising funds to make these things.
Yeah, they might have trouble in one department, but I'm sure their lawyers can sort that out.
Yeah, I mean, there are already companies that rebuild MacBooks into other things, right? Like, there are these sort of ruggedized devices and other things, and they turn the whole thing into a big touchscreen device. So that aftermarket already exists. There are companies that do that kind of thing. And they're pricey, but if that's what you want, that's what you buy. So
it is what I want.
I think these guys could get away with that. The one thing I wondered about the device, it is really gorgeous. I thought until 10 minutes ago we started talking about it, I thought it was just the design. Because I saw this thing, you know, I saw some images of it on Twitter and whatever, and I thought, oh, that looks pretty cool. I didn't realize it actually assembled the whole thing, actually made a working device, which is very, very cool.
Yeah. I didn't, until I saw the video, I thought the same thing, yeah.
It looks like it's kind of, it would tend to, like, tip over forward. I assume they have a pretty heavy weight in the base, but it seems like I would be worried that, like, I don't know, It just looks kind of precarious, right? It looks like it could kind of just roll forward and smack down onto the keyboard.
Actually, maybe that's the thing. Maybe it's actually powered by like a Mac Pro that's under the, you got to, under the desk, you got to drill a, you got to core out your desk. It's all below. It's all for show. I still want it though. But yes, maybe that's it.
Ah, the wonderful internet. It brings us such fun things.
Well, the thing that you guys were just talking about, I think that's a great idea. I'm totally behind it.
A wild Ken appears.
Well, Ken, hello, how are you?
Fine, I'm so happy to have so much to contribute to this episode. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So, Carrington, Sinclair Spectrum Vega.
Okay, well, the Vega, I don't know, I think we've spoken about this on previous shows, but it's essentially the Spectrum reimagined, so it looks kind of like a Sinclair Spectrum, except where did all the keys go? And it has built into it something like 1,000 games. So it's essentially being rebadged and reissued as a console rather than a computer. You can think of it that way. I still think it's a pretty keen little device. They have, the latest bit of news is the manufacturing site has been selected and it's going to go into production very shortly. So if you pre-ordered one of these through their, I think it was an Indiegogo campaign, some sort of crowdfunding campaign has funded this. And if you have placed your order, then you should soon be getting your stripped down, filled up with games and removed all its keys version of the Spectrum. I think it's going to have a total of 5 keys plus arrow keys, and that's it. So, I'm excited about it. I think it's cool. I have not been excited enough to actually place an order, but hypocritically, I'm still including it in the show notes and for others to be extra excited about. Now, did any of you guys actually pitch in and have ordered one of these?
I looked at it, but it just... didn't press my buttons, probably didn't have enough buttons to press. That might have been the problem.
I think it's sad that it's not going to be what I would consider a full computer, that it's going to be essentially a ZX Spectrum game-playing device. It's like the flashback for the Atari 2600, but that is a, console version of an old console. So I have no problem with that. I like the Flashback 2 best of them because you can mod it to take actual cartridges. And I think that's adding software is an important element to these things, computers or consoles. And so here, being essentially crammed full of 1,000 games, which is great, but still up in the air whether they're going to permit changing that set or adding anything, that removed a lot of the desire for me. And the fact that it's not actually a Spectrum, it's not a computer. If it was the same thing, packed with 1,000 games, but with a full keyboard and a version of BASIC, I would be all over this thing. I think that would be amazing and fun. But as it is, it wasn't enough to make me actually order one.
I looked at it, I was impressed, but just not quite enough. Okay, Paul. This is I suppose, a 2015 exhibition that we're going to be. We did the 1985 one, so what's up in July?
Well, the Commodore Convex Expo version 11 is coming in Las Vegas in July 2015. It's put on by the Fresno Commodore User Group and the Clark County Commodore Computer Club of Las Vegas, and it's. It's a big Commodore show. It's July 18th to July 19th, it looks like. So if you're looking for, a Commodore show to go to, this is probably it. There's a lot of details on the webpage that we'll link to. And there's even a raffle that you can enter, whether you go or not for a 1581 floppy drive or a Commodore 128D. So, it looks like it's I actually have no idea how big this is as an event, but it's awfully close to Kansas Fest. But anyway, yes, July 18th to July 19th. Do we know when Kansas Fest is?
That was going to be my question.
Sometime in July, perhaps. But
the Kansas Fest site is counting down to something, but it doesn't say what.
Counting down to an announcement. Counting down to why aren't you here?
I think if you go by the date on the timer, the countdown timer on the Kansas Fest website, the event will begin on Tuesday, July 14th, but there has been no announcement regarding date, speaker, or registration. The website has not been updated since Bob Bishop passed away, and that's it.
Oh, so maybe I could pop into Las Vegas on my way. You never know. Or on my way back. But, yeah. Okay, well, here's a news article that is just going to shock everybody. The dial-up internet is dead. It's official. Yes.
No.
It is. TPG here in Australia, one of the larger second-tier ISPs, has made an announcement that they are no longer going to sell new subscriptions to dial-up internet access. So if you were hanging out for your new i7 computer, you've just got that modem card that you want to put in there so you can connect to the internet, I'm sorry, you're going to have to go look for another provider because TPG just aren't going to take your money anymore. Fortunately, they also have a lovely range of broadband offerings, so I don't think they're going to have too big an impact on their bottom line. But no, I just thought it was interesting that someone was actually saying that the dial-up internet is dead. Did I miss that? I thought it was dial-up internet was dead a long time ago.
Well, not according to the article. They say they still have 20,000 active dial-up services on their network.
It's quite interesting. I think it also said that in the last census, it basically said that there's, 180,000 dial-up users. And I'm sort of going, whoa, that's quite a lot of people. 20,000 subscriptions. I know a lot of them were using it as like a backup connections, but still, that's... it was shocking news that the dial-up was dead and that there were so many people still using it. So I'm trying to remember the last time I actually did a dial-up connection. I think I was running Windows 95 and I actually had two modems in that computer and I was multiplexing my home line and my office line together to get that little bit of extra speed out of my pair of 56K modems.
I think one day in the future... there'll be another article and young people will be laughing at the service that all of us are still using because we are old and we don't want change. And I think because I do a lot of tech support and the main complaint I get is it's different and different is bad. I'll say it's updated the browser. Oh, it's so different. And that's said immediately as if that is inherently a bad thing. And I think probably everybody gets to a certain point in their age, maybe, where they're like, I just want it to still work. I want it to work the way I'm comfortable with. I want my email. Why are you making it different? I bet you we, retro computer enthusiasts, everybody listening to this podcast, will at some point be still, you know, connecting through some sort of fiber network instead of plugging directly into a socket in the back of our heads. And all the kiddies will laugh that we're not on MeetNet the way they are. And so I try not to laugh too hard at the dial-up because I suspect it's people that came on with AOL and it just works for them and they just would rather just spend the $16 a month and have it just work.
If you still want dial-up in the United States, I think you can get it from foxvalley.net, which is a company that's been around for decades and has... often said that they would support machines like the Apple II. I had to go hunting around on their website, but I found a webpage with a copyright date of 2015 that lists all their dial-up speeds and prices. It looks like they actually charge like by the month and by the dial-up speed, and wow, it's a real blast from the past to look at the various protocols that dial-up modems support, like V90 or V.32BIS. And it makes me think about all the old Hayes commands that I used to know by heart, like how to turn the speaker on and off and the volume. Like, was it ATL1, M1, something,
M.
You know? And
it's M.
See? And like, it's just, there are so many commands. Like, I used to be able to drop into the terminal and do, like, ATDT1978 and just dial into the BBS without any sort of a program to do it for me, and you go back and you look at all these commands, and unless you're Paul, it's just like, wow, I used to know all this stuff.
Yeah. I remember having to add the string to the start of the connection so as to make it a Australian Communications compliant modem, and just know, basically put that in the prefix for that. And, you know, these days it's all just plug it in, turn it on. The internet service provider will pre-configure the modem and router and everything for you. All you got to do is add your own password. You do remember to add your own password, don't you, people?
I'm reminded of the days when ISPs continued offering dial-up, but they started transitioning away from shell access. So you had to have use TCP/IP instead of just a text interface. And back in those days, you had to pay for like text, TCP/IP, or both. And you could actually get away with paying for just the text-based access. You could dial into a shell and then use, I think, a command called slurp. And it would fake a TCP/IP connection over a text interface, so you could still run all your GUI programs. Oh man, there were so many workarounds.
Those were, no, they weren't. they were the old days, but it wasn't good.
So a friend of mine here in Sweden, who's also a retro computer enthusiast, he's been playing around with sort of a throwback to the dial-up non-internet days, that is just running a BBS. So he's running a BBS that you can connect to somehow through the internet, and it's actually running. He's actually got it running, I think, on a Commodore 128 or something crazy. So, like, and obviously there's no actual modem involved, so there's software somewhere that acts like a modem as far as the Commodore is concerned. And it kind of makes you wonder, at some point, will we also have emulators to emulate the act of doing dial-up to get to the network. So you can actually type your AT command somewhere in order to establish a connection to some server.
That would be sort of fun. Just AT/DT IP address.
Well, I just recently posted to the Apple II Enthusiast group on Facebook a demo of parallax scrolling using ANSI graphics, and a lot of people were quick to point out that the requirements for such a graphical display were beyond the capacity of a dial-up modem, to which I responded, most BBSs nowadays, or if not most, at least many, offer a Telnet option, so we can't assume dial-up speeds are the maximum for modern-day BBSs.
Although, I'm not sure how much fun it would be, you know, if everything just blinked onto your screen. You really want to see the characters scrolling slowly by.
I miss when modems worked at reading speed. Like, you could actually watch the text come in and keep up with it. That's not possible. It hasn't been possible for a very long time.
Okay, well, Ken, while you've got the mic, we're Earthbound, you're Earthbound. Tell us about it.
Oh, sure. So there is, since we were speaking about potential conflicts with Kansas Fest, there is one else I want to throw into the mix to further complicate people's summer schedules, and that is a convention celebrating the Super Nintendo game Earthbound, which was known in Japan as Mother 2. This game has acquired a cult following ever since its original release back in the mid-90s. It was re-released on the Wii U Virtual Console about a year ago, and people are still clamoring for a localization, a United States official release of Mother 3, which was released for Game Boy Advance, I believe. But in the meantime, there is a vendor named Fangamer, F-A-N-G-A-M-E-R, and they sell a variety of licensed products for Nintendo, Earthbound, all sorts of crafts as well. They recently did a Kickstarter specifically to fund the creation of a variety of Earthbound products and events, and they reached their stretch goal to have an Earthbound convention in Tucson, Arizona. Tucson is also the name of a city in the game of Earthbound, and that is July 18th to the 19th. Tickets are due to go on sale in mid-January, which is now, so Kickstarter backers should get first dibs on those, which would include me, and I would love to go on my way to Kansas City, but we don't know the dates of Kansas Fest, and it looks like it might be the same time as the Earthbound convention. I was hoping they'd be weekend apart, so I could hit up one and then the other. But if you are in the Arizona area and you want to celebrate a classic Super Nintendo game, check that out. Fangamer can be found at fangamer.net, or you can follow up on the updates on Kickstarter, where the name of the project is You Are Now Earthbound. Anybody ever play that game?
No, but if you're interested in picking up a copy, There's a handy site called buyearthbound.com, and all it does is tell you, here are all the ways you can buy it. Here are the, right now on eBay, here are copies right now on eBay. Like, here's where you can buy the documents. Here are the complete sets and what the average prices are. So there's a whole site just for watching when copies of that come up.
Okay, that's dedicated fans.
Wow.
Okay, Jack, I know that Carrington is just emotionally choked up about this next item, so I think I'll let you talk to it.
Yeah, I think that this requires some tender discussion.
Mm.
Well, I think there is no question that the Commodore 64 holds the world's record as the best-selling computer model. On pagetable.com, an article went into the actual numbers of how many were actually sold. And there's been some contention about this because some have said as many as 30 million were sold. And this actually comes from Jack Trammell, who I mentioned earlier. I'm sorry, Jack Trammell, who I mentioned earlier. He wrote this at some point that they had sold 30 million. The author of this article actually gets it down to figuring out that it's probably more like 12.5 million. And this is mostly based on having analyzed sets of serial numbers. And they figured that if they had sold more than this, we would see sets of numbers indicating higher than this. So less than were previously thought, perhaps, but still a big, big number. And that's why we're all so familiar with this Commodore 64, is because so many were sold.
Define computer.
How many do each of you own?
I do have one, but I actually haven't. I've had it for about a year, and I haven't turned it on yet. So, but I will. Actually, this reminds me too. Some many episodes ago, we talked about there was an eBay auction where somebody was making little disk drives, like little compact flash, not SD card drives that you could plug into the Commodore 64, but they're shaped like little 1541s. And one of the features of that auction was that the plastic used to make these things was actually ground up Commodores. So this tells us that it's okay, because there were millions and millions of them.
That sounds like a product that's been released by Advanced Industries.
Absolutely.
I can just see Carrington there with a big pile of Commodore 64s and a large shovel, and just merrily whistling while he works, shoving just pile after pile into the grinder.
I imagine one of those sort of tree shredders, like in the movie Fargo, just shoving Commodore 64s into it.
I wouldn't be doing it by hand, because I would automate it, and I'd have the whole thing run by an Apple II, and it'd be great. It would have just like a smiley face on the display as the conveyors of C64s slide past. It'd be awesome. It'd be like something out of Portal.
Morbid.
Yeah, I think I'll go and increase the bandwidth on our feedback box.
I need a GLaDOS voice to go out of the Apple II would be great.
Okay, Ken, on a more serious note, what's happening?
What do you mean?
Oh, well, what's this little reboot that you're talking about?
Oh, sure, that. This is rather self-serving, as I tend to be. So there is yet another convention coming up, and that is called PAX East, and it is in Boston, March 6th to the 8th, 2015. Carrington, I understand you're not going to be there.
I am not going to be there.
What a jerk, honestly.
I keep wanting to go, but you keep giving panels.
How dare I? I drive you away.
Well, and you keep giving more and more of them. Eventually, it's not going to be PAX East. It's going to be Ken East. It'll just be all Ken panels.
But then that means there will have to be a Ken Prime as well.
Yes, as there should be.
Awesome. Out of the Ken's matrix everywhere. Of leadership.
I'm waiting for Ken Canada. Like, when there's a Ken North, I'll attend that one.
Yeah, and I'll just rename the whole country Canada.
I was going to say Canada would be sounds good.
Sure, why not? It doesn't sound any worse, really.
I'm definitely moving.
There's no hiding, Carrington. So PAX East is attended every year by about 70,000 gamers. Those are video gamers, computer gamers, board gamers, role-playing gamers, etc. It is held at the Boston Convention Center in the Seaport District of Boston. It is hosted by Penny Arcade, which is an online webcomic. And I will be attending and giving a panel. I'll be moderating a panel called Reboot Your Roots, Bringing Our Favorite Genres Back to Life. And this is a panel about how Kickstarter and open source tools and mobile games and the like have made it so easy for us to make our own games that a lot of people are doing so to keep their favorite genres or even franchises alive, even though they may or may not be commercially viable nowadays. So, for example, we have Katie Hallahan on the panel from Phoenix Online Studios. A couple of years ago, I gave a talk at Kansas Fest, and I included their game called The Silver Lining, which was an unofficial sequel to King's Quest. King's Quest was at that time a license that had lain dormant for more than a decade, and some fans decided they wanted to make their own sequel. So they made one called The Silver Lining, which you can download from their website. This same studio, Phoenix Online, has now published an official remake or reboot of the Gabriel Knight series. Anybody ever play that?
Yep.
You a Gabriel Knight fan?
I am indeed. And I've been a fan of the King's Quest, you know, the remake things have been available. I recently played through King's Quest 1 with a friend of mine, and we played the new version in a sense. It was fantastic.
Yeah, there's another group out there, I think they're called AGD Interactive, and they have basically a license to remake old Sierra games as long as they don't charge for it. But The Silver Lining was actually an original game, and the Gabriel Knight game was made in collaboration with Jane Jensen, who created the original Gabriel Knight. So the panel will feature Katie Hallahan, Steve Alexander, who has created a line of games called Quest for Infamy, which is very obviously inspired by Quest for Glory, and Dave Gilbert from Wadjet Eye Games. He has created a franchise of games called Blackwell, which is not itself based on any specific game license or franchise, but is very heavily inspired by them. If you take a look at how the games work, you'll say, oh, that's the kind of game I used to play 20 years ago. So that panel will be held on Sunday, March 8th at 1:30 p.m. in the Bumblebee Theater at PAX East. If you want to stop by and say hello, it's sure to be a great one-hour panel. There will be other panels all throughout the weekend. I'm on a couple of others as well, but that's the only one that's really relevant to the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Cool.
Excellent news.
Paul, you're right in Boston. Are you coming to PAX East?
I am not. But do they actually release videos of the panel panels afterwards?
There is no official video recording of the panels. It is up to each individual moderator or panelist or organization. I was able to get a video made of the last panel I was on last year and the year before that as well, so I'm hoping to do that this year. But we'll see. I definitely want to have this one on because there were a lot of people who I invited to be on the panel who they're based on the West Coast and weren't going to be traveling east for this event, especially since it coincides with the GDC Game Developers Conference on the West Coast. They were more likely to just hop down to California for that event rather than travel to Boston from Seattle. So I definitely want to show them all the fun they're missing and hopefully use that as a case for having this kind of panel at other PAXes, because there are four PAXes. PAX South is occurring a week from now, January 23rd. In Texas, and there's also a PAX Prime in Seattle in late August, and also a PAX Australia.
Well, that's quite a bit of news this time around. But yep, so it looks like Ken finally managed to get his dial-up connection working and join us for the show.
All microbees are supplied with software. The entry-level bee has its software built into memory. You can choose from a menu of preloaded programs or load from your own library. All microbees are supplied with communication software. Used in conjunction with the inexpensive Bee modem, this allows you to send and receive information, access computer bulletin boards and electronic databases, and connect to Viatel, Australia's national video tech system. Viatel is a goldmine of information and services. You can use it to send telexes and electronic mail, do electronic shopping, electronic banking, book travel arrangements, and even monitor share prices on the stock market. The Viatel service offers hundreds of thousands of pages of electronic information. Communication is what the microbee is all about. Disk-based microbees come in a range of formats. You can choose either single or dual drive units using compact and high storage capacity drives.
The disc-based bees use the well-established CPM operating system. Our implementation is one of the friendliest available, using Bee Shell, an icon-based control menu which makes the system very easy to use. Microbees are robust and require little maintenance, and a school's investment is also protected by the evolutionary design. No microbee need ever be outdated by changes in technology. Existing equipment can be easily upgraded without incurring huge costs. In advanced applications, the student can be linked into a network, allowing the sharing of peripherals such as disk drives and printers under full teacher control. There are two network systems. The simplest is BNet, which allows the teacher to rapidly load new programs into all student workstations simultaneously. This is extremely useful when using more than one program in the course of a lesson. The second network is called StarNet. This is a much more sophisticated network, and it allows each student's workstation to function as if it were a fully configured disk-based computer. The top-of-the-line microbee is a powerful 32-bit machine built for high-speed computation and graphics. It is supplied with a standard 256 kilobytes of RAM, which can be greatly expanded. The Gamma is designed for the most demanding user and can run several programs simultaneously. It has an extremely high screen resolution of 720 by 350 pixels with a palette of 4,096 colors. It also has advanced features such as direct memory access, which means that the main processor is not slowed while data is loaded from disk. The Gamma employs several microprocessors, making it possible to configure the computer to run most industry-standard operating systems and software. Few personal computers have ever offered such flexibility and sheer power, and none has offered so much for such low cost. The MicroBee Gamma is a breakthrough in computer evolution. MicroBee Systems has consistently built tools for today that have grown with technology into the tools of tomorrow. Every MicroBee ever made can be upgraded to meet the future. MicroBee Systems, the evolutionary computers.
Okay. Host gift idea. I was a bit of a loss what to put in this time, so I thought I'd just something a little bit different. So continue along with my favorite Star Trek theme. Here's a little something for just to make you feel nice. So here we are, Star Trek Red Shirt Fragrance. I suppose it's supposed to attract that imminent demise as soon as you teleport down to the planet's surface. So when the monster comes out, you'll be smelling your best.
That is timely because this past week was the 20th anniversary of Star Trek Voyager.
Mm.
I can't believe it's been that long since we got introduced to the Delta
Quadrant.
It
still feels like the new spin-off.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I actually don't watch these... any of the series very religiously, but I think of that as the new one.
Mm.
Oh, instead of Enterprise?
Well, Voyager is the last Star Trek to run a full 7 seasons.
And I am one of the people who actually liked Voyager. I know it's much maligned amongst the Star Trek fans, it seems, but I dug it.
Mm.
I liked it too. It was a good one.
I mean, I was a fan. I don't think it's the strongest Star Trek, but I certainly did enjoy it more than I disliked it.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on that one. It was I enjoyed it more than I didn't, but yeah. But I'm your original Star Trek kind of guy. But here we are, as I said, just a little bit something different. So rather than having some geeky shirt or phaser remote control, a little something that you can sort of like wear to work and hopefully not offend too many people. Okay, well, on buying things, there's this wonderful little place called eBay. But we're not going to go to eBay first. Carrington, what is this mechanical analog computer all about?
I have actually selected an auction not on eBay, which I almost never do. But yeah, there's a Mac. I have selected a Mac, but not the Mac you would think I would select. Instead, not by Apple. It's Mac for mechanical analog computer for flight. So it is a flight computer from the 1950s, late 50s though, 58 I think. I know nothing about this. Other than, I think it looks totally awesome. It looks like basically a cabinet. It even has a roll top pull down part to it, which is fantastic. So it's like an old fashioned desk that way. And so it would sit there looking all desk like. And at any point though, you could lift up, slide up like a garage door. You could slide up the roll top part. And underneath is a full mechanical computer with a running tape and those little pens on arms that like, I don't know. I think of them as things that would register earthquakes. It's one of those. So supposedly this is a computer far before my time. I just think it's a beautiful looking device. I just like it for its like aesthetic appeal versus what you might do with it. The starting bid is €7,500. And so with a 22.3% buyer's premium on top of whatever you purchase, estimate is that it will go for somewhere between €10,000 and €20,000. The auction is passed already, and so this didn't sell. I emailed the company, this live auctioneer site, and it's going back up on the block, which is why I selected it. It will be offered for sale again mid-summer, but they haven't set a date yet. But at some point in, they think, end of June up to sometime before the end of July, this will once again go for sale. It is still available, and I just think it's lovely.
I must admit, I've never seen anything quite like this before.
I think it's huge.
Mm.
Is it not? I mean, do we have any idea what size it is? It looks like they're a little like notebooks and things.
Yeah, it's 163 inches by 61 by 195 inches tall, I think, which is 5.5 feet. I don't know what feet is. Maybe over 6 feet.
Yeah, you could hide a flat screen panel in behind that roll,
yeah, it's
roll
quite,
top.
It's quite large.
Make for a unique TV cabinet.
Yeah. So I've selected an auction item that isn't actually available, but I think it's neat enough. It was a way for me to bookmark it so I can keep my eye on it for when it does come back up. Not that I'm going to buy it. I just think it's cool.
Excellent.
Oh, and the other, as an alternative, I'm going to do what we call doing a poll. I'm going to select more than one. There was a NES Stadium events up for auction that was bid up to like ridiculous levels. When I last looked at it, it was at over $100,000. Oddly, it closed at $35,100. So it's an odd thing, and it seems what's happened is there were a very large number of canceled and retracted bids. I don't get why that was going on, but it was. So many, many, many bids on this. It looks like here's a canceled bid for $240,000. So it was bid up into the stratosphere by people who then just canceled their bids, I guess just playing with it. It did eventually sell, and I don't know whether money will change hands, though, for a little in excess of $35,000 US, which I think is a heck of a lot to pay for a Nintendo cartridge.
But it does say it's factory sealed.
Whatever. I have whole issues with it's factory sealed, but it's also been rated by that that group. What are they? The Video Game Association, and they are just all over the place with their ratings. They treat video games as if it was art, and they try to act like they're an art evaluating company. There are many people and many organizations that will do this for comic books, for other forms of media. The VGA tries to do it for video games, but they are wildly inconsistent. And you send them items, they will seal them up and send them back to you, but they seal them in boxes that can just be reopened very easily, so you can't really trust that it is still sealed and hasn't been tampered with since it was evaluated. So the VGA here has got a VGA rating of 85 and in near mint plus, and whatever. VGA ratings mean nothing. I have no respect for that organization whatsoever. So there you go.
Well, regardless of how it's rated, this is the rarest 8-bit Nintendo game that was ever made available for purchase. It was quickly recalled and then re-released with a Nintendo Power Pad, which is why this version of the game, which does not support the Power Pad, is so rare. As far as we know, only 200 ever made it onto store shelves. There's a great video of somebody who a year or two ago just bought a whole box of 8-bit NES games at a yard sale. And he is basically live streaming as he gets the box home and is going through. And he's like, oh, Mega Man 2, cool. Tetris, cool. You know, DuckTales, Duck Hunt, etc. And then his jaw just drops and like, and he stops breathing because he's looking in the box, which you can't see on the camera. He's like, oh my God.
And then he stops the video and go tell his mom.
Something like that. But yeah, like he got a copy of Stadium Events, which is super rare. I think 3 years ago, a copy of this game sold on eBay for about $22,000. So $30,000 for this latest copy is pretty much about what the market demands for this game. It's remarkable.
So is it fun?
Is that money? Who cares?
Who cares? I mean, there are really two schools of thought. I mean, it's the people who buy the comic book and immediately put it in the bag and never read it, or it's the people who buy the comic book and, you know, stick it in their back pocket and read it on the subway home. I mean, if you want to play the game, then you can, you know, probably find some means to do so online without resorting to one of the 200 copies that actually physically exist. So if the game is fun, I don't know. I remember having fun with it when I played the Power Pad version, but that game was so easy to cheat because, like, if you want to do the long jump, you're supposed to be running on this DDR-like pad, and then you jump. All you do is you just step off the pad, wait a moment, then you step back on. That's a long jump. You know, it's a big controller. If you need to be running really fast, instead of running in place, you just get down on your knees and you slap the buttons with your hands. So, I don't know if this game is fun without that opportunity to cheat.
I think we're learning more about Ken than we're learning about the game.
I was going to say, that would make for a great play video.
I'm not doing a Let's Play of Stadium Events with or without the Power Pad.
Oh, Ken.
Nor do you want to watch me play DDR, but thanks.
Okay. Well, let's have Paul do a poll. I'm not even going to try and pronounce this one, Paul, but take it away. What have you found?
I found an auction for, it is a USSR Soviet vintage 16-bit computer, Electronica BK0010-01. So in the show notes I put it in Cyrillic, but it's just Electronica. This is interesting. It's not super cheap. It's 348 by it now. And then to me anyway, shipped out of Russia, it's $60 more. But it is, so I guess this is a, so it's a Russian computer, it's a home computer, but it's a PDP-11 compatible. So, which, these things seem like, they're dissonant in my brain. But apparently this was very popular sort of home computer at the time, but it happens to also be PDP-11 compatible. And it looks really cool. It's black and it's got mostly white keys with gray keys around the border and a red something or other.
That's probably the missile command launch button.
Right. It comes with a box, comes with instructions. It's all in Russian. And there's nice pictures in the auction, and there's a video of it starting up and things being typed in Cyrillic and tests being run. I could at least read tests in what was happening on the video. But it's an interesting computer. I'd never heard of it. And I think it's kind of neat that it's a PDP-11 compatible.
I was going to say, if I wanted a PDP computer in my collection, this one goes to the top of the list. It's superb.
And it fits in, like, whatever space you have.
This is one of your best finds, Paul. So, what else have you got that could possibly top this?
Well, yes.
Funny you should mention, he says.
Also, I did pick one other auction because I was meaning to put this in last time, but it just got, there were too many. The other auction I have is a, it's a TRS-80 plug-in power controller. And so it's a little box that you can plug into a Model 1, 3, or a Coco. It's basically an X10 controller, so it lets you turn lights on and off and things like that. If you plug it into the power outlet and you have a sort of appropriate receptacle to plug a lamp in or whatever, it'll communicate over the electrical wires. One of the things I kind of like about this kind of a unit is just that it's something your retro computers can do now. They can actually turn lights on and off. You know, they can, you know, you still have lights and you still have the electrical circuits and they could still work. This particular one is only $19 at first bid. It doesn't come with anything. It's just the box, but I think the box is the main thing you need. I'll have a link to another eBay auction that's more like $90, that shows you like all the stuff that came in the box. But, if you can find the software, it looks like this has the cables, and $20 seems like it might just be, the right price to have something to, you know, turn on and off your coffee maker or whatever.
Like X10 might not be the greatest home automation system, but I think you're really going to be rocking it if you can have your TRS-80 controlling it all.
It would be nice to sort of chain them, you know, have your TRS-80 turn on your Coco, which turns on your toaster.
And all my programs are actually printed to the toast, so I have to check for syntax errors before I butter.
Kind of makes my offering sort of somewhat pale and insignificant. But as far as Commodore computers go, it was pretty pale and insignificant. So I've highlighted a Commodore C16 computer. And I know they weren't that big in the US, but I've actually seen a few of them kicking around here in Australia. What can be good, that can be said about the C16 is that it's better than a C116. But it's interesting what companies will put out when they're chasing the bottom line. So this was basically the sub-$100 offering coming in after the VIC-20. And basically, you know, take out all the good bits that you need, force people into peripherals that they can't use on anything else, and they end up making adapters and putting it in there. So not the greatest computer that was ever released, but I think it's a nice little addition to your Commodore collection if you're looking to just fill in those spots. So a little bit on the pricey side.
Yeah, I don't really know too much about this machine. I know it was sort of my impression is it was kind of a watered-down C64 with less RAM and stuff. I really don't know what the software situation was. Would it run C64 programs as long as it didn't need that much RAM? Or
any of the peripherals? I think it's more of a collector's piece than something that you're going to want to be actively using. I think it's accurately described in Wikipedia as the C16 was a flop. I think that pretty well sums it up. It seemed to get a little bit more traction overseas as a low-cost computer. But I vaguely remember using one, and when I first saw it, I thought it was a VIC-20, but no, it wasn't. But just something that little bit different that people can go looking for. So, Jack. Now, this one is really different.
Yes, this is actually, it's not a computer. It's not a piece of software, although it is soft.
And you wear it.
Yeah, it's software.
And you wear it. This is the Boy Scouts of America official computer knowledge patch. It is shaped like a 3.5-inch floppy, so it has a little notch, the 45-degree notch out of one corner, and where you would have the label typically on a 3.5-inch floppy, it says computer knowledge, or rather actually computer-knowledge. And where you'd have the little sliding metal disc protector part of the 3.5-inch disc, it says BSA and has the Scouts logo. Very stylish. You could wear this anywhere and it would show that you know how to operate a computer and that you are a Boy Scout, which I think applies to all of us. I'm sure. So, and this only costs $9.99. That is 50% off, according to this site. So, and they've got four of them. He's only got four. So act now.
No. I'm not going to be greedy. I'm going to let someone else buy this one.
And I would just like to point out that in Canada, we don't have Boy Scouts We have scouts, and both boys and girls are welcome to join.
Yes, the same here in Australia.
Yes, Scouts Canada, just saying.
Same here in Sweden also, just scouts.
I suppose it's really...
Ken, answer for yourself. Yes.
I have a whole podcast about feminism and equality.
Clearly you don't. until you change this. I'm reading from the Scouts Canada page. Scouts Canada does not discriminate for reasons of gender, culture, religious belief, or sexual orientation. Suck it, America. In fact, the words "suck it, America" do actually appear on this podcast.
What I find most interesting about this is that, apart from the fact that I was in the Scouts here in Australia, every time someone did a presentation and the initials of BSA came up, it took ages for the troop leader to sort of like get any order back in there, because BSA just meant something so different here in Australia. So
for me, BSA is a motorcycle company.
Mm. Yeah.
Clearly it's something terrible in Australia.
Yes, well, the last one is artist.
Okay.
So even in my teens.
Perhaps there's a badge for this.
I don't know. Some of the IT stuff I've seen, BSA would actually be quite accurate. But no, it's interesting. What I like most about it is the cutoff corner to be, as you said, 3.5-inch disc-like. Well, that was definitely a different assortment of items. So, gentlemen, closing discussions. What's on in your world that you just want to give that last plug to?
Well, I'll chime in first, because I've got some stuff in the show notes here. First, I have been surprised at how big Atari disk drives are. I have a pair of, because I've got my Atari 800, which I'm still loving very much, and I have a pair of disk drives for it. And they're the Atari 810 model. And I'm way out of my depth when it comes to Atari stuff. So I'm still learning, and everything is brand new to me. But the thing that's really shocked me is for all the years I looked at the Atari 800 and lusted after it, because it's still one of my favorite pieces of industrial design. I think it's an absolutely just gorgeous computer. I adore everything about the 800 design. But these 810 floppy drives are mammoth, like absolutely just giant. The pair of them side by side are a little bit bigger than my Apple IIe. I mean, they are just huge things. And I guess it's because, and this was news to me, all the controller and all the intelligence is actually inside the drive itself, and it's just connecting over a dumb serial connector to the 800. I had no idea that these things were as large as they were. Even having them, I didn't realize how big they were until I set them on the desk and had to make room for them. So that's been the new experience for me, is dealing with these mammoth floppy drives. And the other thing is, to bring it back to the thing we talked about at the very beginning of the show, that Apple Graphics and Arcade Design book, the Stanton book, I am enjoying it hugely, because I am working on essentially my first graphical Apple II game, hopefully to be released at Kansas Fest. And what I have now learned, having always been just really a text guy, is the memory in the Apple II, the memory layout for graphics, is insane. And what the heck is going on with that? I guess everybody else has dealt with this, and I'm the newcomer here, but I have a whole new respect for arcade game designers for the Apple II, because was this made bad on purpose or something? Like, what? This is the most insane layout for memory. I can't even get my head around why it is as bad and ridiculous as it is, and it's a hassle. So, just saying, I've learned to appreciate that the memory is terrible and Atari drives are big. Those are the new things in my retro computing life.
Well, you should definitely listen to the recent Player Missile podcast from a month or so ago, where Paul gave all the dirt on this stuff. I do found this fascinating and somewhat concerning, how weird it all was. It was pretty cool to learn, but it's weird.
Okay, Paul, what's happening in your end of the world?
Well, I feel like I keep saying the same thing, so I will keep saying the same thing. I'm still like kind of trying to dig out my office and working with these disk images that I've collected and will be scanning things. There's one quite fairly interesting thing that's coming up that I'll tell you about next time. But things continue.
Oh, that's good. Same here. Things are pretty much same as usual, just trying to get Chaos exited from the 8-bit bunker, a little bit of order there. So instead of programming my entry for the retro challenge, I basically tidied up part of the bunker, and actually you've got somewhere I can sit down and watch TV down there, and then found a box of books, which I sorted and put onto the shelf instead of programming for my retro challenge entry. So I think I've been doing some retro procrastination, but that's going along fine. So, Ken.
Yeah, I am super happy with a package that arrived in the mail last week, completely out of the blue, without any forewarning, and I brought it upstairs, opened it up, and it was a half a dozen issues of Scholastic Microzine that I didn't already have.
Ooh, nice.
I've been collecting these for the last 4 years or so, and I'd just been doing it on my own, and I was getting like an issue here or there. But then I think I mentioned it at either Open Apple or Kansas Fest, and apparently people didn't know that I was looking for these, and they just started being delivered unto me in hordes from James Littlejohn and Dane Nichols. And this latest delivery comes from Dane Nieder, who apparently was inventorying the Apple Link library, which is the Apple II users group of Lincoln, Nebraska. And he had some duplicates or just some that they didn't need anymore. So I told him which ones I was missing, and off they came to me, which is phenomenal. I was super happy to have them, so thank you to Dane. And I have been chatting with Paul about maybe getting these imaged, which is, I think, beyond my capabilities, but is consistent with something that Paul's been working on.
Yep. Or hopefully we'll have all of them sort of imaged and available soon. I think they're not yet, though.
And you have some other issues that you've been working with somebody else to image?
Yeah. So I have a few of these of my own. Someone on Twitter, D5AA96, has been imaging a lot of these. He's actually sent me a bunch of the binders and magazines that were inside, or the manuals that were inside, to scan. So hopefully a pretty complete collection of microzines can be assembled, through the efforts of all of us, so that they can finally be all used. But I think they go up to 40.
Excellent. And Paul, with you and I being right in Boston, I'm happy to hand deliver whatever you need out of my collection.
Cool. Yay. Will be happy to image.
Do either of you have a list anywhere available online that would let people know which issues you do not have yet?
No.
No.
I think Paul and I privately have collaborated on which issues we're missing, and I have my own personal list of which issues I do have, but maybe we can put that... Where would that best be put, Carrington?
On kengagney.com/gimme.
Okay, the first half of that URL will work. The gimme part, maybe not so much.
Well, once everything's processed.
I'd like to point out the D5AA96... It's been bugging me as soon as you sound like, I know that. That was the address mark, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is the best.
As soon as you said that, I was like, hold on. Why do I know this particular bit of hex? So, wow, that took a while to bubble up, but okay.
Wait, wasn't that code on the cover of Juice GS a couple of years? D5AA96. Yeah, that was on the cover of Volume 12, Issue 2, back in June 2007.
Yeah, it's on the license plate of...
Roland Gustafson.
Yes, right. Copy protection master for Broderbund at least, but I think he did work for other people too. He wrote an 18 sector DOS and so forth. But his license plate said D5AA96, which is also beautiful.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And that issue featured an interview with him. I for some reason I didn't make the connection between that and the Twitter user we are now speaking of. Fascinating.
They are two different people, but Roland Gustafson is also on Twitter. So occasionally he will come out of hiding and respond.
Oh, neat.
Okay, so Jack, what's happening at your end of the world?
Oh, I just want to mention one little thing as a counterpoint to Carrington's point about the Atari 800 disk drives, which are enormous. I've got a cool device that lets me not have to worry about any of that stuff at all. The SAO2SD, it's a thing that lets you... Basically, you put files on an SD card, plug it into this little adapter, and the Atari thinks that it's looking at a disk drive.
Okay, this is what I'm talking about. Nice. Because I've got an equivalent sort of thing for my Apple II. This is exactly what I want. I am going to be buying one right after the show. Excellent. Thank you.
This thing is fantastic. You don't have to worry about those huge drives, and everything is fast, and essentially loading games feels instantaneous compared to what it used to be. So
I recently picked up an SD to SCSI adapter. because I'm going to be replacing my internal hard drive in the SE30, ideally, with something solid state. And so I'm going to be playing with that. But yes, I sort of want to get rid of the floppy.
Yeah.
I'm less interested in the floppies than the rest of the hardware. So yeah, so something like this. A little pricey at €71 or €72. But yeah, this is, if it works, then this is exactly what I'd love to have. So fantastic.
Yeah.
Yep, I picked one up a few weeks ago, and it's amazing.
Awesome. Good tip.
Yeah, I love those disc adapters. Well, okay, well, that's it for this show. You can find show notes for all RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vintagecomputer.com in the Vintage Computer Forum. You can follow us on Twitter at rcrpodcast. And, of course, you can send us feedback at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And I'm sure there's been a few comments made today that you might want to throw your 5 cents worth in. We are a member of the Throwback Network, and to help others find this podcast, if you could please write us a review on iTunes. A nice one would be very, very nice. Thank you. Well, guys, until next time.
Retro Compute!